excuse me, both of which were developed during the war for and sold to the government for synthetic rubber and use in the radar, in the development of radar. What other projects did Beckman Instruments work on during World War II related to wartime work for the government?
Those are the main ones. I'm trying to think of any other special project.
You'd mentioned some work for the Manhattan Project.
Oh, yes, we did make some mass spectrometers.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, well, that's right, I forgot about it. We made Geiger counters and things like that, too. I forgot about that. And also we made these little pocket electroscope thing for measuring dosage, you know, mm-hmm. Yeah, I forgot all about that. That was made in another company, that was made in Arnold Beckman Inc., so remember that was this other setup we made to make oxygen analyzers, you know, that Pauling had developed. And our board of directors didn't want to take that on because it was under secrecy wraps, and said they didn't want to buy a pig in the poke. That well, I got permission then to do this as a personal venture to help out my friends at Caltech. A lot of interesting stories connection with making that. Did I talk about that?
No, please do. I'd like to hear more about
it. We had worked out Holmes Sturdivant, who was an assistant to Pauling, came over one day and wondered whether I'd provide him with 100 wooden boxes for an oxygen analyzer. And I found out that the Navy had asked Caltech, and Paul was involved, to come up with an instrument for measuring the partial pressure of oxygen. They hoped to use it on board submarines.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a demonstration instrument to show that they could use the phenomenon that Faraday had used, based on the fact that oxygen is paramagnetic. It's almost one of the only common molecules that is paramagnetic. All the others are diamagnetic. Slightly. So if you measure the paramagnetic susceptibility, why, you could measure oxygen for all practical purposes. And a very simple instrument, you just had a magnetic field with a field gradient in there, and then they put a little ball in there, a little glass ball, and they used two of them because the, like a dumbbell, because the mechanical forces were much greater than the magnetic force you measure. So you balance that, and that was suspended on a quartz fiber. And that would rotate slightly in and out of the magnetic field until the magnetic force was exactly balanced by the torsional force and the quartz fiber. And then you had a little mirror on that, a beam of light, and you have a spot of light come out on a scale. Very simple thing. It worked. So they were going to make 100 of them. And we provided with the boxes. Then it came back later on, wanted to know whether we'd make the instrument. They found out that making 100 instruments to predetermined specification was a little bit different than making one demonstration model. And they had a group of people, none of whom would ever work before, girls primarily, and then doing this thing. So this is what I brought to our board director, said, no, we don't want to do it. So I set up a little place over on State Street there and passed in nearby, and I took over the group from Caltech. And well, what a good, fine people, but none of them had ever worked before. And they came in and started to make these things. Well, one of the main problems they had to solve was what kind of background music were they going to have. They knew that industry had background music. Well, you're going to have popular music, you're going to have classical music, and things like that. Well, let's see, but worry about this. In the meantime, they couldn't make these things. Now, this oxygen analyzer involved making these little bulbs about an eighth of an inch in diameter, very thin wall of glass, and joining them together so they're perfectly balanced. Well, making those bulbs was quite a problem. I didn't realize this because I taught glass blowing, among other things, at Caltech, and I didn't give a second thought to this. These were made by blowing a bulb on the end of a very small capillary, which was the connecting link between the two. Well, the surface tension of molten glass at that small radius of curvature is such that it takes about all the force you can generate with your lung to overcome. Mm-hmm. And as soon as the bulb goes any, the radius, it just blows out like that.
Well, I know.
Caltech had one man that could do it, Herb Sargent. He was a PhD candidate in organic, Herbert Sargent, chemistry. He worked the techniques that he could learn just how to coordinate his muscles and clamp down, bite down on the blowing tube, something like that. He could get maybe 1 out of 100 or 1 out of 200 that wouldn't blow out. That was a source of supply. And he was leaving Caltech in about 3 or 4 months, got his degree to go back. Well, I said, not a very reliable source of supply. And this caught me completely unaware. So I went down, realized what was wrong. It had a mismatch in the capacity of this small bulb and the volume of your lungs. So what you had to have was they make a blowing machine, which you had a small bulb, a small source of air, compressed air, which would pressure would drop down automatically. So I went down shop one weekend and made probably the world's smallest glass blowing machine. There's nothing more than a sliding valve, you see, which you had to a little depression, a little volume in there. You could transfer that over from a tank of oxygen or air over to the thing. But of course, since the volume was small, as soon as the bulb began to blow, the pressure went down. So we went over to about 100% yield, 99% yield, yield of one. But that was one of the things I had to do. That was used in production then for years and years and years. Well, this is one of the things we had to learn. And also then you balance these things. We had the balancing was very difficult. The mechanical force were 100,000 times something like that, what the magnetic force. We had to balance this very, very carefully. We do this initially by putting little dabs of glass. We finally got down to the point that wasn't it. So we got the final balancing by vaporizing on silver chloride. Just a little bit of that, because you couldn't touch the thing, you see, to vaporize. And we got so we could balance these things beautifully on it. You could twist them around and all of them. The other thing was making the quartz fiber strong enough, because that had to be. And if we learned the techniques on that, you make a fork out of a fused quartz, fused silicate, and then we just mechanically compress that a little bit, seal the fiber in there. We had to learn just enough to put the right tension on that. And we had to draw these fibers. See, the torsion, I think, terms I recall on the fourth power or something like that of the diameter. So we had to draw these down to precisely the way they were, you know, the way they were making the quartz fiber that time. They take a small quartz rod, maybe half a millimeter in diameter or something like that, heat it up in an oxidizer flame, pull it out of proper coating, and it'd pull apart. And somewhere in there then was a quartz fiber of the right diameter. You couldn't see it. So the way they would do it, they'd take a label and wet it and pinch it, make a V out of it, and where they thought it was, they'll push that out there and squeeze the label together, and then if it fell to the floor, they didn't have it. If they had the fiber in there, well, it would swing. That was the way they actually got the fiber. Well, we had to learn how to draw these contingent, put up a bicycle wheel and spin around things like that. Well, these were some of the problems we had working on there. And we finally made them. We didn't supply many to the Navy because the United States Navy, because they were still arguing over specifications when the war ended. We sold quite a few to the British Navy, who couldn't. But the sales of it were just demanded. And then in 1953 or 4, an article appeared in the Saturday Evening Post. I recall by two doctors from Johns Hopkins, I recall. They'd been concerned over the blindness, high degree of blindness in premature babies. Something like 1/3 of all the babies would be permanently blinded. And doing a piece of chemical detective work, they found out that the incidence of blindness was highest in the so-called best hospitals, those that had the best equipment. found what they were using, were using these infant incubator, I call them, running up high oxygen content in there to help them breathe. But when they got over 40%, then retroventral fibroplasia came in, that permanently damaged the thing. So that what you had to do is keep the oxygen down below 40%. Well, that article appeared in Saturday Evening Post, not in a technical journal. Well, our sales right up because pregnant mothers would ask the hospital if you got one of these oxygen analyzers. So that was the story of the oxygen analyzer.
Was that after the war?
It was after the war. 53 or 54, right in there. This article appeared in the Saturday Evening Post.
How long did Arnold Beckman Inc.?
Well, that carried on then for several years. And when they began to sell oxygen analyzers in some quantity, then we began to have confusion between our customers. What's Arnold O. Beckman Inc. and what's Beckman Instruments Inc.? So we finally decided we ought to fold a thing. So I told the board of directors, sure, I'm going to stay out of this thing. If you want to buy it, you come up with what you think is a fair price, and I'll take it. So they did, and I forget what it was. $1 million, some round number they put on there at that time, and that was a good fair price. So we merged the two at that time.
Now, was that the first entry of Beckman Instruments into the health field?
The pH meter then.
That had been used.
Inspectors were all used in health. Yes. Yes, I recall. Matter of fact, we rushed up airmail a spectrophotometer to a hospital in Oakland where Mrs. Kaiser was very ill and like that, and try to save her life from that.
That just shows my own short-sightedness. I always think of pH meters and spectrophotometers in chemical laboratories and not thinking of them in clinical applications. So it's they had been used from early on.
Yes, both of them are widely used in hospitals and medical research. Good.
Let me ask you a couple of things about the period before the end of the war, and then we may go into some of the post-war things. The first is that when you took on as president of Arnold O. Beckman, you've mentioned your board. You had a board of directors.
That's a Beckman Instruments.
I meant when you became president of Beckman Instruments.
Yeah.
Who were some of the early members of that board, and how did you organize that?
Yeah, they were members of the National Postal Meter Company, and they consisted of Lowell Stanley, who was the accountant and the treasurer of National Postal Meter, and continued on almost until his death. He died just a few months ago. There's Jurgens, A.T. Jurgens. Then Fred Ehrman, who was a partner of Lehman Brothers at that time. What happened on that was that there was a group of investment bankers, five or something like that, of which Lehman Brothers was the lead person. They bought Jurgens Oil Company. And in the course of buying that, they found that here was an asset, called Beckman Instruments over there. Well, they came over to see what it was. We were in South Pasadena struggling and all. Well, the other members of this investment group were not interested in this thing, but Fred Ehrman was, so he stayed on. The rest of them bowed out of this thing. And so he came on our board, and that was my first introduction to finance, certainly to investment, because up to this time we'd grown entirely out of earning, and he saw our growth curve on here, which is still about 50% a year out of earnings. He said, could you go faster if you had more money? I said, yes, because we have a lot of research we'd like to do. We can't afford to take on this to say when we're making the decision, did we dare to go into NMR or anything like that? But we're limited solely by the available funds. We could borrow money, but I was reluctant to borrow more than have more than 25% of our total equity tied up in loans. That was an arbitrary number. I said, well, why don't you go public? And so we went public then in 52, I think so. Mm-hmm. I think that's right. Mm-hmm. And that was a result of Fred Ehrman. owned the Eleanor Ray Westman, who was the lawyer for R.A. Westman for W-A-E-S-T-M-A-N. He was a lawyer for the Jergens Oil Company.
Mm-hmm.
That was, and Buzz, I.H. Lyons, who was president of the National Postman Company. That was the board.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was very heavily influenced by the
origins. They owned it, you see. Mm-hmm. And we never did have a board, I guess, for Arnold Beckman Inc.
The other question I wanted to ask, in let's say 1944, when the war was in full swing, but the promise of the end of it was there. What was the breakdown of your products in terms of dollar volume, and what were you thinking about the post-war
world? Well,
I'll
have to get the number. My memory is not good. I can get that for you. But I should point out there that we had split off Hewlett-Packard. Munson Hewlett-Packard had made 40% of our profit in the first thing. Well, as time went on, we got concerned because they were tremendous. We couldn't make them fast enough. Oh, no, that was a limitation. We were concerned that the government might force us to stop making pH meters and things like that, who did not carry the AAA priority, put all of our production into Hewlett-Packard. So we split off Hewlett-Packard as a separate corporation. And that was in this period on here. And then later on, we folded it back into the company again after we moved out to Fullerton after 54. That was so that I have to give you both Hewlett-Packard and Beckman Instruments, but I remind me to get that information.
Hewlett-Packard must have, clearly you're making thousands of those. You were making thousands of Hewlett-Packards, but only about 100 IR instruments. Do you recall about how many pH meters were being made then? Was in order of magnitude?
Well, I can give you the actual numbers on that. I'll get to those. Sure, how they go.
Yeah. And the Hewlett-Packard was
going. I think we sold, if I recall, 87 meters the first year. I'm guessing now, but anyway, in connection with our 50-year history, we did bring out those year-by-year figures the first few years.
Yeah. Well, as you looked at the likely shape of the post-war world, what did it? What implications was it carrying about?
You're making an assumption, you see, that I did look ahead.
Okay.
I was enjoying myself going to make these things. I have to confess, at that time, I did not sit down and come up with any long-range projections. Mm-hmm. Later on, after Fred Ehrman came on the board, then we did that, because he brought in some more of the conventional investment reasoning that had to come on here.
Was that a direct consequence of going public, do you think?
I think so. Yeah, I think if it hadn't gone public, it was just a happy little family affair drifting along and trying to stay in the black and things like that. But he brought in a larger scale look where you had outside shareholders. You have a different type of responsibility then.
Going into the post-war world, when did you begin to get actively re-involved with Caltech? By 1964, you were chairman of the board. But
yes, I went back on the board in 53, was it? I think so. Yeah, I think it was. Because I maintained close personal relations. We lived right there, you see, and went to parties together and went to seminars. So that I never lost contact. I lost official relationship with it, but of course then through the Pauline Oxen, I was the biggest contributor to their patent royalty fund there for one, not a lot of dollar, but still it was the largest one, but the only one there for a while. And, so I maintained close relations. And I recall I was back on the board. See, DeBridge came back in 46, and I think it was on the board in 53. Norman Chandler, LA, owner of the LA Times, and I went on the same time. And when, I don't know when I became chairman, 65 or something to do.
Yes. The early period of Caltech with Millikan and Hale and so on has been studied from a historical point of view. But the era immediately after World War II is not yet subject to historical scrutiny. Who were the great architects of this? Who do you see as the key?
You see, Caltech was going through a change in thinking. I mentioned earlier that Caltech was a pure science institution, and its people did not get heavily involved. There were a few who could do consulting work, particularly like Dr. Lacey, for example, who was out of there. We didn't have chemical engineering. We called it applied chemistry in those days. Well, Dr. Noyes encouraged him to have some company, limited contact, primarily with the Petroleum Institute. He was studying the thermodynamics. He and Bruce Sage were studying the thermodynamic properties, you know, of hydrocarbons under high pressure and temperature. So that was a one. In the electrical engineering department, Dr. Sorensen and others were concerned with the high voltage transmission of electricity. And then, so a few, and also, and the water, the Metropolitan Water District coming along, and Dr. Franklin Thomas was involved. But these were pretty largely special, large-scale projects of interest to Southern California, and the instance that it had an obligation to help out the local community if it could. And, well, that was just about the situation. Then World War II came along, and the physicists particularly gotten into chemistry, but particularly physicists got involved, and they set up a facility up in the Arroyo Hotel. Let's see, you had a lot of physicists, got Smyth, had Dumond, I think who were the leading physicists there. Of course, Watson, Ernest Watson, who was Millikan's man Friday, and he was involved in this with him. And the chemist Pauling was involved in this thing. Well, this was they went out and really put together a what we'd call later a think tank sort of a operation up there. And this is the first time that Caltech really wholeheartedly got behind a practical applied type of activity. Get away from so this is when the tide turned. Now, since then, and they found also they got paid handsomely for this consulting work, which may or may not have had something to do with the acceptance of that role.
Was there, in the years immediately after World War II, was there a serious thinking about going back to the way of doing business in the 30s, or did people all see this as an irreversible change?
I have to keep in mind, I'm not on the fact that Caltech at that time, you see, so I'm a little bit of an outsider. But no, I think that the change was permanent. You see, they were, for two or three reasons. First is, I think they saw that science by itself, for sake of knowledge, was really not a complete story. Until you use science some way for the benefit of mankind, well, you haven't completed it. So I think that was brought home to them. And also, I think they learned that applied science was not necessarily dull and low level of intellect involved or something like that, which some of them assumed before. And otherwise, they found that highly interesting, I think, to be involved in the problems of industry as well as his government. So I think it's a whole change in they opened up their eyes to a new world for many of them on there. the world of applied science.
Just staying with Caltech for a minute, that in your period as chairman of the board there, what would you characterize as the major opportunities and problems that you faced, and the major thrust of that period as you now look at it?
Well, for one thing, that was the first time that Caltech had to put on a fundraising drive. Up to this time, money had come in primarily by personal solicitation of Milliken. He was a great fundraiser, but there'd been no formal organized drive, so we put on a drive. As I recall, it was either $16 million or $19 million, or put it on a scale now. And yeah, I remember that. Tell you another. I don't want to bore you with these human interest stories, but it's all these things have a. Well, that's just a little early. This is in. '58, I guess it was. In Africa, in the year. Anyway, I was having a boat built up at Sausalito, one of the first large fiberglass boats, 40 foot tall, and I was sailing it down and over the Thanksgiving holiday of '58, I think it was, and this is rather our fundraising drive. And I was chairman of the fundraising thing, and we were having a meeting scheduled in at the Caltech to ask them there to kick this thing off. So I recall it was on a Monday evening. And we're sailing down with the boat, and we got becalmed. And I realized it was not going to get down here by 1 o'clock. So finally we pulled over at Goleta. There's an old, partly abandoned pier sticking out there. And I hopped off and went over to the highway to get to hitchhike a ride so I could get in. And finally, this is my first experience in hitchhiking, and it's not that easy. All these cars go whizzing by, whizzing by, whizzing by. Finally, a fella stopped in an old T-shirt, and he's a plumber. He'd been up at Camp Roberts hoping to get a job, and he did get one, so he was coming by. So he stopped and picked me up and told me I'd get back to Santa Barbara where I could telephone and that. So he put me in. Turned out that he and I had a little in common. We were both former Marines. He also was an AA, which I was not, but anyway, we got along well like that. And he took me home. But when I got to Santa Barbara, I called Ed Valentine, who owned the Robinson store there, his family did. He was the vice chairman. I called Ed and said, I'm not going to get back here in time for this thing. Will you go over and hold the meetings? All right. So he did that. And the next day or day after that, the Los Angeles Times had a column about Arnold Beckman hitchhiking down from San Francisco. He wasn't able to make it in time to kick off this thing, you know. But of course, they played it up. But right along the next picture in there was Zsa Zsa Gabor. They had something about her. So I never lived down that hitchhiking experience. But I mean, that, like, the main thing now, of course, is the modesty of that campaign compared to what we had now. You don't have $100 or $200 or $300 million, right? You don't call it a campaign.
Yeah,
that was one of the first things we had in there. And Caltech was gradually expanding the way through, and there was always a problem on campus as to whether engineering was being slighted with respect to science. The engineers thought that's perpetual problem on Earth, but that was
what could you do with that problem except sympathetically listen?
Well, we sit down and talk with him, and the guy, I think that was when Bob Cannon, I think, we brought in as director of head of the engineering school and things like that. No, you just have to, this is a problem that the provost has to handle, see how you're going to allocate the funds between the two. There'll always be a problem. And to a lesser extent within the scientific division too. The biologists think they don't get as much as they should. Too much, the chemists get too much. The chemists have always fared pretty well at Caltech, and I think that's going back to the days of Arthur Noyes. And the fact they've had a good chemistry department there that they've... Now, I'm trying to think of developments during that period. That'd be 64, I guess, to 74 was a 10-year period when I was chairman. Do you recall anything that...
No, I'm actually, since it's not as a matter of historical record, I'm...
One...